Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at IKEA-USA.com/circular. Visit IKEA-USA.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Hi, everybody. I have another live show coming up in Los Angeles on Friday, May 26th at NerdMelt. Special guests will be announced shortly, but you can get your tickets at NerdMeltLA.com. For updates on who will be joining me on the show, please follow Forever Dog on Twitter at Forever Dog Team. And you're listening to Kevin McDonald's Kevin McDonald Show on the Forever Dog Podcast Network. Today's show is brought to you by Casper.com. Yay! Receive $50 towards any mattress purchase. Mattress purchase, yay! At www.caspertrial.com/KevinMcDonald. We're also sponsored by WarbyParker.com. Get a free 5-day home try-on at www.warbyparkertrial.com/KevinMcDonald. 5 pairs, 5 days, 100% free. If you're a fan of Kevin McDonald's Kevin McDonald Show, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes and rate and review us. Be mean. Be cruel. Yes, we started. I'm Kevin McDonald. Hello. And we, that makes me sound like the queen, a royal we. I am sitting here with Craig Finn. Craig, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you. So far we've talked about water, and I'm sort of concerned that was the best part of the conversation.
Well, I think we can top it.
Top it. But New York water, see, now it's clear. We got glasses of water. And it was sort of pretty fuzzy, but when I lived here in 1987, it was sort of a green fuzzy and stayed that way forever.
Yeah, I've only been here since 2000, but it's been pretty good since I've been here.
Yes. Now, I remember there was a big newspaper thing in Toronto when I was living there in 96. We go, all tap water good now. And I hope that was true.
Does that mean all everywhere? Or all in North America?
I think they meant all in North America.
Okay.
Yes. I don't know. Mexico. No offense to Mexico. I'm so sorry, Mexico. It's because I got the don't drink the water thing in my head, but that's probably not true. All right, I start out by insulting a country. I'm very excited to talk to you, Craig. I'm a fan.
Awesome.
And I'm not even lying.
Good. Let's not lie to each other.
I won't lie to you. If I was lying, I wouldn't have said the I'm not lying part. I would even said I'm a fan. I would say something else, but I am a fan.
Good.
Let's start out of order. I have some questions on the airplane. Oh, that's a crazy question to start with. Should I start with a question that makes no sense?
Let's go crazy.
Because you'll probably just say no.
Right.
I've been listening to a lot of your albums. I had 2 albums even before, like in the 2000s. I love your new album. We'll talk about that in a second too, out of order. Are you a fan of Peter Case?
I'm not super familiar with Peter Case. He was in the Plimsolls, right?
Yes. Your work reminds me of his solo work.
Okay, good. It's something good for me to dive into because I know, you know, A Million Miles Away.
Yes, like the birds. That's a great song.
From the Valley Girl soundtrack.
Yes.
But I love that song and I always have, but I don't know his music that much. And so that's something he's been at it a while, which I love persistence.
Yes.
And I like. At my age, like I love discovering a guy, someone now that has a deep catalog. That's one of my favorite things. So then you can go into it. So that's a good one.
That was a great thing about the early 90s and CDs. I've only heard Stevie Wonder's singles. Let's get every Stevie Wonder album.
Yeah.
And now I guess you can do that streaming, but I don't really know how to. I don't stream successfully. I don't know how to do it. But
it's overwhelming, but I sort of feel like the same thing in a used record store. Like I'll find a Van Morrison record that I haven't heard, and I'll be like, it's $4. I'll take it home and see if there's some hidden gem of a song back there. And there's fun in that.
When Merle Haggard died, I bought his first 7 albums, and I'm kind of enjoying them.
Nice. That's a fair amount of music. That's enough to form an opinion.
Because they sell double albums, and Okie from Muskogee, even though it's not my politics. Well, Bob Dylan said Okie from Muskogee, he said it's written so sharply, he thinks Merle Haggard was parodying right wingers.
I think it was, wasn't he? Or at least he was trying.
He became more left wing lately.
Was he maybe trying to just show the other side? I always assumed he was kind of trying to write from a bit of a character, that one. But I
think
I don't
so
know.
Too. It's sort of moving to me. I apologize.
Well, no, it's all right.
I'm a left-wing liberal from Canada. We're going to talk about you, I swear to God. But first, I want to remember the name of the Peter Case album that you've got to listen to because it reminds me of your work. It's something, no something, something waiting. Waiting, no wheels, something. I'll find out.
That's enough for me to figure that's out. Waiting, right?
Yeah, waiting's, I think waiting's in it.
Okay.
Or a word that ends with ing.
Okay. Well, there can't be more too many of those.
I enjoy your new album very much.
Thank you.
I think it might be my favorite albums of the four that I have of yours.
Wow. Well, I appreciate it. It's certainly one that I'm proud of and I'm excited. And some people seem to like it. It's been out a few weeks now and people seem to really be reacting to it. So it's interesting to me that one thing that comes up, a lot of people are saying it's this sort of, you know, it's much different. And to me, it doesn't sound that much different than the two that preceded it. But it doesn't matter because if people like it, they like it. That's great. But to
me, there's more of a sense of urgency to it.
Maybe. I would say it's more musical in the sense that by I wanted it to be kind of richer and fuller and maybe there's more people in the room. Like actually in the recording process, there's more musicians
like
around.
That too, yeah.
You know, so there's something less sparse about it, and there's more. And even like, you know, if you have like this is kind of inside baseball, but like if you have like, you know, a multi-instrumentalist, so in my case Josh Kaufman, producer, plays a lot of instruments, and so if he plays guitar and then he plays bass and then he plays piano, you're kind of getting the same thing, doing same person doing different instruments. So just the actual act of putting different musicians in the room all right. playing together, you get something that's more musical and it gets more human.
And do you well, I'll switch questions. I'll go with the flow. I'm trying to listen as an interviewer.
Yeah.
Does the concept of the album, maybe not thematically, but sound-wise, I'm trying not to sound pretentious. I said something 10 seconds ago that I'll regret later. The sense of urgency. I can't believe I said that. But does the sound in your head change? I guess, of course, it does when you get to the studio.
Yeah. I mean, I have like – I don't think I have fixed ideas in my head as some songwriters and some musicians do. I think that I kind of write, like, especially in lately, the way I've approached these records is to write a skeleton and get it to kind of as good as I can get it in a sparse way, where I'm happy with the story, I'm happy with the words, I'm happy with the melody, and then get really good people that I enjoy both their playing and being around and getting in the room and saying kind of like play what you feel with a little direction, but sort of like, you know, play what you feel, play what you're hearing and seeing what comes out of it. And usually being very happy with that, the result of that.
How do you write an album? Are you always writing and then you go to sign up these songs together? Do you take some time off from writing? Do you wait for the idea? Or do you sit down and force yourself to think of the idea? Think of an idea for the album first, or do you think of the idea of the song first? That's my question.
I think of the idea for the song first. And I go into sort of these writing periods where I'll say, like, I'm going to write a song every day this month. And oftentimes they're terrible songs. And you just sort of write them and throw them away. Or I'll say, like, a lot of times it's 10 a.m. to noon. Like, I'm going to write a song. And I don't think it's going to be, you know, amazing, but if I write 10 of those over 10 days, I might look back a week later and find three of them that are like, oh, that's pretty good. And then I start working on those and I start editing them and I start changing them. So I find that if you have something, you can move things around and edit and change them, or if you have a blank page, you're stuck with a blank page. So I really do believe in pushing through and kind of saying, well, I don't know what I should write about today, but I guess I'll write about my cat or
right.
what I had for breakfast. And the idea later is that you can change it. You know, maybe that song about your cat isn't that good, but like then you say like, well, what if this was actually about my best friend from seventh grade? And you change the name and you change a few lines and suddenly it's like something that's a lot more meaningful.
When I listen to Bob Dylan's Slow Train Coming, I think it's a beautiful album, but all songs are about God. I pretend it's about his ex-wife, and I think it's the best album ever.
Yeah, I think it's probably there's a lot of that out there. You know, I mean, I've certainly done that in reverse, where I've hear a gospel song and like that's nice, but I don't know if I can go all the way there. And maybe it's about my cat, or my friend, or whatever.
I'm waiting for your Cat album to
come out. Yeah, it's a movie. That's what you start with, and then you try to move away from it.
So you don't, because you get the idea from listening to your albums that there's sort of a conceptual theme. You don't start thinking, I'm going to write a bunch of songs about this theme. You let the songs carry you to the album?
Yeah, actually, you know, there's some part of making a record that you're planning, you know, and then sort of some of it reveals itself to you. And so, like, when I, you know, I probably had like 40 songs when I went to Josh, the producer, when we started this record. And we, you know, I immediately threw 20 away, and then he threw 10 away. And, you know, not throw away, but say, like, I don't want to work on those right now.
Right.
And so when you have left, you sort of see, like, wow, in this record, I wasn't planning. You sort of find out what you're thinking. I mean, I think Joan Didion has a quote like that, something we write to find out what we're thinking.
That does ring a bell.
And I feel like there was a lot of, and I don't know in particular why this was connected to my real life, but there was a lot of songs on this record that are kind of about, partners and two people like trying to get through, and almost this like sense of codependency in a number of the songs. People kind of in this like less than Disney version of love, you know, like I call, you know, strategic alliances and uneasy truces, but not head over heels in love, but, you know, sort of this real kind of realistic modern way. And I think it's, you know, I mean, it's like you live in New York, people, you know, go on three dates and move in together just because rents are high. So it's like, you know, you see what, like, sort of a realistic way of, I don't know, looking at things. And I that wasn't something I was setting out to write about, but that's kind of what ended up.
Right. That's kind of exciting that you sort of know that there's sort of a theme in your life, like the classic Adele kind of thing. You write your classic breakup album because that's in your head. But sometimes I find people's breakup albums, as much as they're made fun of, are their best work sometimes.
Yeah.
Because they mean it so much.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, you're raw and you're, you know, I think, like, if you write towards what's happening in your life, it's probably a good idea. I mean, you can't, like, you know, if you're like, you know, you lost your job, it's probably, my thinking is that your songs about that will probably be better than your songs about, you know, dragons.
Right. And if you're really good, you can do something in between. I think one of my favorite Bruce Springsteen albums is Tunnel of Love, where he was having doubts about his marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not such a, I'm going to have a doubts about my marriage album. That's not the story. But he felt it very strongly. And I think it's probably, if not the only doubts about my marriage album, it's the strongest.
Yeah, probably the strongest. yeah, I mean, you know, you have to, you're always looking for these things, whether you're trying or not, end up in your songs.
Right. Right. Yeah. Some of your songs, a lot on this album, but a lot in your career, seem like they could be like either modern-day indie movies or movies from the 70s. Did you ever think of writing... first of all, do you think of it that way when you write? Do you think of it visually at all?
Yeah, I do. I've always been trying to make something cinematic, and I've always been trying to like tell these stories that are like big. And because, you know, I think that's a thing, and I've said this before in interviews, like... It seems like to me songwriters get held to a different standard of, like, you know, people expect things to be confessional.
Right.
And you know, no one expects Quentin Tarantino to shoot people and do karate, you know.
Right.
And it's like, but a songwriter, you know, it's like, I don't know if he really – and I've even said that and seen that in reviews and my mind stuff and the Hold Steady stuff especially. I'm not sure they did that, you know. And it's like – I'm not sure that that's the point, you know. I think you want to create honesty. I mean, you cannot do everything that's in your song, but you can still be honest in your approach to it, emotionally honest.
The feelings can be true.
And but I think, you know, with the Hold Steady especially, there's such big music that I wanted to create something that was big, and it doesn't – it can't always be mundane topics when the guitars are wailing and all that, you know. So in the Hold Steady, kind of, I feel like big things happened in the songs, you
right.
know. Desperate,
music drove you to that.
Yeah, desperate characters doing big thing, making big bad decisions, you know. Where with the solo stuff, I feel like it can be a little more mundane and a little more detailed in that sense, and that's kind of where I've gone with it. And I think especially on this new record.
Yeah, for sure. You sort of break, I'm a very simple man, and I see things very simply, and I always think of artists, they're either John Lennon or Paul McCartney. They're either confessional like John Lennon, or they're imagination like Paul McCartney, but maybe I'm wrong, maybe you're somewhere in the middle where you're sort of having imagination, but it's sort of, I don't know if it's through your experience, I don't know what your life is like, but there's some confession of feeling going on.
Yeah.
Are you in between McCartney and Lennon?
I think so. I mean, I think that it's, there's something like, if you can kind of tell a story that may not be, that may be a fictitious story, but hit on universal truths. That's the power. To me, that's where real power lies.
Yeah.
So I think in some way you want to, you know, and these stories, you know, I mean, I think, was it Gregory Dunn? Joan Didion's husband, actually, I think, said that the first character in every novel is the novelist. And I think that's, there's truth there. I mean, these stories don't come out of absolutely nowhere, you know, I mean, you know, like in the new record, there's God in Chicago. Well, that's a story about, you know, people going from St. Paul to Chicago. Well, I made that drive a million times.
That's when I thought could be a movie for sure.
Yeah. That, and, you know, that was what I was trying to create in those 4 or 5 minutes, whatever is the, this very linear story that you could follow.
Do you know the people in your songs ever, or are they made up?
Well, both. They're composites. They're, but there's certainly, you know, there's a little bit of few people in probably all the songs, and I certainly know and knew a lot of people that are like, you know, like the those types of characters in the songs. But you know, there's very rarely, if ever, just a one-to-one relationship like that's that person. I've actually had people come up and say, like, I think I'm that person in that song. And I'm like, I'm sorry to disappoint you. And it's like, no, I really think that's me.
No, don't sue me. So your songs, as I said earlier, are like movies. You know the Al Pacino movie, Panic in Needle Park? I
think
that could have been a song of yours.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great movie. Those are, I mean, those 70s movies
are like ones, your songs.
Well, those are ones I loved growing up, you know, I mean, that kind of era of cinema and being gritty. But, you know, like that movie has tenderness too, you know?
Absolutely.
And there's love in, and love and tenderness in, you know, less than ideal circumstances.
Yeah, it was dark times. Love and dark
times. Yeah. So, what was it? Didn't that all take place on the Upper West Side? Which seems like
where was the park? You know, I haven't seen it for years.
I think it was up there, and it's hard to watch now and not be like, well, real estate has changed. You know, New York, it always comes back to real estate in New York, and you're like, wow, that neighborhood's not like that anymore.
It's gentrified. Yeah. Well, because this is the question I'm leading to. I'm very excited about my boring questions, but I'm excited about this one. Have you ever thought of writing novels or scripts?
Yeah, and I've even tried. I've written some stuff with friends, but it hasn't really gone. I worked with a friend, my friend Tom Ruprecht, on a film adaptation of the Chuck Klosterman book, Fargo Rock City, but we were kind of unable to drum up much enthusiasm about it. It was funny, but I think it had some flaws. And then I've tried to write novels or start novels, but those are very hard. They're solitary pursuits, you know. And even as a solo artist, as a musician, you know, you get a producer or musicians around you who are kind of like, no, that's great, that's great. And like, you're like, oh, it is. Where a novel, you know, you get 10,000 words in and say, should I be telling this in the third person? And maybe, you know, you hit delete and throw it out. So it's something, I mean, I read a lot of novels. I kind of consider novelists to be like, I put them all on a pedestal. I don't want to leave this earth without one. But that said, I haven't started it.
Maybe start with a book of short stories.
Yeah.
That's what an album is.
Yeah, that's kind of what an album is. That's what I think I should be doing. But, you know, it's funny. I think of a story and it turns into a song. So
right.
I don't have any stories left over, you know.
You must be worried writing and then a melody comes to your head.
Yeah. Like, I also think, like, a song is kind of awesome because, you know, like when you think of a short story, like a Carver, Cheever, Chekhov, whatever. Yeah. It's sometimes a lot about what they don't tell you and this tension that's created.
Absolutely.
And a song kind of is like that too, you know, like,
absolutely.
Like I love the idea that, you know, sometimes the way when I'm writing a song, that I find that it seems better to me is when I suddenly take out a verse.
Right.
You know, and you're like, oh, well, then that verse over-explains something. And
someone's famous for that. And that's also what Kurt Vonnegut said. It's a lot of what isn't in there that sort of makes what's in there sort of works.
Right, right. And there's, you know, there's different things that you're looking for. And it's almost like a symmetry or a crossword puzzle, like, you know, like the crossword puzzle where you get like the long one on the bottom and it all comes together. Sometimes you have that line, you know, but it's sometimes finding something that, like, you know, finding something that you think is a little humorous. Like that to me is like, if I can find something that kind of makes me smile in a song, especially if it's a sad song, I'll be like, yes, you know, like that's what I want.
I was listening to your album again this morning and I was thinking that I hope people appreciate this about you. There's wit in your sad stories, and they're not sad, like they're more, not sad isn't true, there's sadness in them, but there's wit in them. Woody Allen, when he made his first serious movie, Interiors, I like it now actually, but at first I thought it was a failure because he took all the humor out.
Yeah.
He wanted to make it real, but it wasn't real because there is humor in sad stories. And I think later he discovered he got better at his, so my question to you, I don't know what it is, but is there humor is in your songs, right?
I think there's humor. Yeah. I mean, I always think that, like, and I don't do this anymore, but I used to really find that the stuff I liked that I wrote best when I was really hungover. And I've kind of gotten away from that because I don't think it's a very good, it's kind of a destructive way to live your life. But there's a certain bleak, dark humor that comes from a hangover that is like, it's kind of a hopelessness, but you're kind of laughing at yourself because you've done it to yourself, you know?
Yeah.
And I find that voice kind of entertaining. But I do believe, and I don't think this is a controversial opinion, that the best rock and roll has funny moments. I mean, from Dylan to Springsteen to Mick Jagger to Chuck Berry, Nick Cave, everyone, I think, pretty even Paul Westerberg, I think all the stuff I really love has some really funny parts, you know?
And Chuck Berry's lyrics are underrated. Like Brown-Eyed Handsome Man, those lyrics are amazing. But even the wit in his like more popular songs.
I just did an interview actually where someone asked me if I liked Chuck Berry and asked, or you know, what I thought, and said that, you know, one thing is, and I agreed that he was always very specific, you know. He wasn't all like, he'd tell you about Maybelline, not just some girl he knows, you know, not a girl in a red dress, but like Johnny B. Goode. And then he put them through these adventures kind of, you know.
Yeah.
So there's very fully realized stories in there, you know, and a lot of this word is specificity. Specificness. of, you know, he used to carry his guitar and a gunny sack, sit beneath the trails and the railroad tracks. He's really putting a picture.
Those are great images. That would be great prose.
You're thinking, wow, he carries his guitar and a gunny sack. Yeah. Like he doesn't have a hard shell case for it. And he's like the best guitar player ever. That's kind of amazing, you know?
You're making me appreciate his lyrics even more. Because I know he's known for starting rock and roll guitar in a way. But I think his lyrics go under.
Something that I read when he died that was really interesting to me was about how he kind of created the idea of a teenager. And I don't know if that's correct or not, but I get it. I get what they're saying, you know? Like when I was a kid and I'd hear Chuck Berry, I'd think, like, that's kind of what about a teenager is being like. Also that and Fun, Fun, Fun by the Beach Boys.
I was about to say The Beach. The Beach Boys made me think of what it's like to be like a teenager driving a car.
You know, Fun, Fun, Fun till her daddy took the T-Bird away. That seems like something that would happen when you're like, that's what I thought like teenagers did.
And I'm a Brian Wilson fanatic. I'm not supposed to like Mike Love, but I think Fun, Fun is great lyrics.
Yeah, really good lyrics. she got her all about the library, like she told her old man. That's funny. That's good.
And I think those are maybe his best lyrics. But I know I'm not supposed to like Mike Love. I'm sorry if you're listening, Mike Love.
I don't know. I mean, it's some of this rock and roll, like you're supposed to do it or you're supposed to not. I mean, we're not supposed to we're supposed to be mad at Robbie Robertson and stuff, but it's like,
I can't be mad at Robbie.
Yeah. But it's like, you know, like I wasn't there, you know, like I, you know, these things get, we're taking a lot of like people for granted.
I refuse to be mad at Robbie, but I won't be mad at Rick for being mad at Robbie.
Yeah, right. Right. I mean, I just think it's like, it's not my battle, you know?
Exactly.
Like,
exactly. I'm fascinated by the songwriting process. Do you find, What comes first? It probably comes all different places. Do lyrics come first? Do the chords and the melody come first? And do the melody sort of write the lyrics? Or is it all different?
It can happen different. With the Hold Steady, it very much happens where, you know, I'm mainly contributing words and, you know, vocal melody. So, like, they show, you know, Tad, the guitar player, usually starts the song and has some riffs that he's got put together. And then we'll play and I'll be yelling into a microphone. And, like, somehow that a form of song will come out. But with the solo stuff, it's me, you know, sitting at home with a guitar and, you know, sitting down to write a song. And kind of very, very often it's getting the first line. I'll say, like, you know, like, that's the first line of the song. And that's where it goes. And let's see where it goes.
Oh, wow.
And even I think, like, God in Chicago. No, that's actually not true. God in Chicago, I think I had a St. Paul de Cicero in a Chevrolet with a boombox. Wait. Went from St. Paul to Cicero in a Chevrolet that didn't have any radio. That's what I said.
Yeah.
That's what I had. And I was like, well, what kind of why are they on this road trip? But I think, like, the first song on the album, Jester and June, I guarantee I started on the first line, which is the bartender sold us something, I think was probably coriander. And I was like, oh, what happened there? Like, you know.
Right.
So I think a lot of times it is the first lyric and following it down the trail.
Wow.
Never with a chorus first. I'm just not a big chorus guy. So I think, like, a lot of songwriters are like, I got a chorus, now I need verses.
How can you write the chorus first? But though, if you don't write the chorus first, and you're a guy who needs, you're a big chorus writer, you must be kind of nervous. Okay, this verse is going, okay, I would think of a catchy chorus now.
Yeah.
What pressure.
Right. Like, I think, like, the verses don't even start with those guys until they're like, finally, we've got the chorus. But that seems like research and development to me. You know what I mean? That seems like, is that,
that's exactly
how
it.
Emotional can that be? But I, there will be a lot of people that disagree. But the way I'm kind of like, I just kind of keep writing the verses. And one of them ends, the second one I write, the third one I write ends up being the chorus.
And sometimes you don't write the chorus, right?
Yeah, sometimes I don't have it.
Sometimes you Bob Dylan it, which I love.
Yeah.
And Keith Richards, what did a lot of the Rolling Stones songs, he said this is in his book, he would think of the riff and one line, like, I can't get no satisfaction, the riff, give it to Mick,
yeah,
and then Mick would write the lyrics.
Yeah.
That's kind of neat.
I think that's I could totally see working like that. That's cool. I mean, that there's this sort of thing with the blank page where you're like, oh, I could do anything. It's sort of overwhelming. But if they say, I can't get no satisfaction, be like, oh, okay, I can work with that.
Imagine being Mick and getting that. Here's the riff. Here's the line. You write all the other words.
Yeah. Well,
that's,
you know,
great.
Yeah. Did you see that movie with Metallica, where they went to therapy? Do you saw that? Yeah.
Oh, yes. I love them.
I remember the scene of them all where they all said they all wanted to write lyrics, and everyone else was just cranking out pages of lyrics, and Hetfield was just like, what? You know, like,
I write the lyrics.
You know, like, he had nothing, and it just felt like 20 years of lyrics had just boiled out. I thought that was funny.
Do you identify with that movie? Because I'm in a comedy troupe, and I identify with that movie.
Yeah.
Everyone in a group must identify with that movie.
Yeah, you do. I mean, you see, like, you know, there's a lot of time spent, and, you know, the travel under you know, difficult conditions and just amount of time and, you know, communication can get difficult. I think that the Metallica one, there was some kind of financial stuff that didn't, like, right, like that maybe compounded the problem that I didn't quite relate to, you know.
All right,
like I didn't have to, like, meet with my art dealer at any time, you know. So, but I actually think in their case, it seemed like that might have made it worse rather than better. Although, you know, these bands that stick around, like, people are like, God, the Stones are still doing it. It's like, you know, they don't ever have to be in the same room with each other.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
There's just this buffer of money.
And they can spend a year away from each other.
Many.
The thing I identify with Metallica were little things like when James Hetfield didn't want to work past 5 p.m. because he was quitting alcohol. It's not the alcohol thing I identify with. It's the social problems. But then he got mad when they kept working.
Right.
It's not the alcohol thing. It's it's that little problem that happens a lot in a group, I think. That, one guy, there's no real leader, but one guy sort of acts like a leader.
And that's a really...
I'm sure Lars is like a leader. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's a very... I mean, the rock band is an imperfect beast because of that, because there's a leader. Everyone's supposed to be cool, but there's no leader, but then there's a leader, and then,
yeah,
you know, and then, but then it's like, you know, he can't be not cool. Like, yeah, exactly. There's a lot of, you know, in some ways you see, like, well, you know, fraternity, the seniors tell the freshmen to clean up. And then that's how the house stays clean.
Exactly. There's always sort of a little bit of, did you see the Wilco documentary when Jeff Tweedy fired the guy and he said, and the guy was fired, he said, but I thought you hired me to contribute to be a band. And he said, every circle has a center. But I guess that's kind of different because Wilco really is Jeff Tweedy and Jeff Tweedy can pretend that it's sort of a group.
I love Wilco, though. I mean, like my sense was.
You're so right. It's become a group now.
Yeah, it's become a group, but also like it seemed like at the beginning, the narrative that I knew that Jay Bennett was sort of another, you know, a second, at least a second, you know, if not a total equal. And that was, I don't know if that's true. That was my perception from outside and being a fan. But and now it's very much a group. But Tweedy's obviously in the center of that circle, as you say. I mean, I
hold steady. Are you're obviously the center of the circle, or
no? I mean, it's pretty democratic band, but yeah. At the same time, I mean, by nature of being singer, and also by nature of just sort of being having ideas about how things should go. But I run it by everything. Like, there's no, like, my word doesn't just stand. If someone says, like, no, that sounds lame, we don't do it, you know?
Do you ever feel that you could say to them, I have to quit at 5 every day, but I don't want anybody working after 5? Do you feel you could say that to the whole study?
They would be supportive if I had a reason to do that. Yeah. We've had things that have happened that we've had to make arrangements for that kind of thing. And everyone's sensitive. It's a very good group of people. They're my best friends. And there has to be sensitivity about that. But someone has to kind of take the lead. And I wouldn't say I'm the leader, but, like, you know, I am the guy who's like probably most likely to send an email and say, what about this?
Right.
You know,
right.
Let's do this show, or let's try to do this, you know. But that's something that's just kind of come from years. I mean, and I assume that the comedy troupe is similar, where after a while, people start getting used to their roles a little bit, right?
Yeah, the shift, though, and that's where I'm coming from. My troupe, where there's supposed to be no leader, but of course there sort of is. But we have enough confidence in the fact that we play the game, there is no leader, that if someone said, I don't want to work after 5, but you guys can't work either, it'd be a big fight.
Okay.
But that's... And over the years, I guess one of us has sort of become a leader only because he does the business stuff. He does the organizing.
Yeah.
And he's become a behind-the-scenes, like, director and producer. And that's sort of more, like, convenience. It's so easy for us that he's a bit of a leader.
I had a band.
Lovely Bruce McCullough.
I had a band before, Hold Steady, called Lifter Puller. And we've done some reunion stuff. And, in fact, as recently as this past December. And it feels like when we get together a little bit, like, everyone, even after, you know, maybe 5 years apart, sometimes 10, everyone kind of slides right back into their role.
Yes.
In this familiar way. It's not bad. It's kind of nice. It's pleasant. It's familiar. But it's funny. No one shows up and starts fighting for a new spot, you know?
It's familiar, but if you're one of the two guys in the unhealthy for yourself roles, and you're 50 now.
I mean, there has to be. There's throughout, and I feel like rock and roll is, if you stick around in rock and roll, and this is something I've come up with in the past year, because I'm 45, and if you stick around rock and roll, it sort of becomes like, who's still drinking? Who's still partying? You know what I mean? Right. Like, is he, he's off.
Right.
You know?
right.
So, it's a sad but true statement of affairs. It's just like, you know, I mean, like, most people have to kind of draw a line in the sand if they're going to keep, you know, going on big tours and all that.
It's true. And the ones that don't, they're the ones that are in the news, but they're a rarity, really.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's also people who kind of just hold it together.
Like Keith, I guess.
And they don't – I wouldn't put him as that example. I think there's a lot of examples.
He doesn't hold it together.
People who are kind of like, you know, I mean, I don't – you know, I think there are a lot of people that are just moderate. And we don't – they don't make the news.
Oh, right. I see what you mean.
You know, but there aren't tons – like, it seems with a touring lifestyle, it's harder and harder for people to just remain on moderate, you know.
Right.
Because there's people even that I meet, you know, that I know that will be like, they're like 10 years older than me, and then all of a sudden they're sober, you know. And it's like, wow, okay, well, that's – I mean, it's good, that's what I mean. It's sort of rock and roll seems to, like force you to come to that point somehow or something.
Right. You mentioned Lifter Puller. I'm obsessed with groups, My first conscious memories were my aunt playing me Beatles albums. So I always knew I'd be in a, I thought it was going to be a music group, but I always knew I'd be in a group. Lifterpuller was a great group. The whole city is a great group. What makes one group touch a nerve with the public? It doesn't mean that one group is not as good as the other group. And what makes one group does? The Kitchen Hall, there were like 10 or 11 of us, and all of us were as good as the five of us are now. But when people started quitting because it didn't look like we were going to make it, and it became the five of us, we weren't the five best by far. But something happened, the chemistry. I complimented that guy, who complimented that guy.
Yeah.
Lifterpuller, Old City, what is it that makes one group? First, ask generally, then specifically with your two bands. What makes one group hit a nerve and the other group doesn't?
I think if we knew this, that we would be very wealthy men. You know, yes. I mean, I think there's some magic that happens, and it has to do with both with things internally. Within the band and the chemistry, and then externally sort of the audience is ready for it and sort of these other timing things. I think, you know, Lifterpuller, I always joke, would make a better movie, and the Hold Steady's a better band. But,
right.
Because the Lifterpuller was very like just had sort of four very strong personalities and like create and we were younger and we were kind of feral, so like there was like crazy things happened, you know, like both at our shows and after the shows, where the Old Steady quickly, you know, fairly quickly was a little bit pro. I think with the Old Steady there's a couple things. One, I think that we were all a little older and we were pretty focused.
The fact that it's second sort of helps a bit, right?
So we were focused and we kind of got on and I think timing was another part of it. But Lifterpuller was in Minneapolis, Hold Steady was in New York. So New York opens up some doors, that's obvious, you know?
Right.
And then at the time there was a lot of like, you know, we were coming off of things like this sort of early 2000 rock thing in New York, which was the Strokes and Yeah. And,
right.
But more than that, like sort of this dance stuff with a lot of like the hi-hat that went and you know, real in a very fashion forward kind of thing. And we kind of came out as these Midwestern guys that drank a lot of beer and had like, you know, kind of a bar rock sound, E Street Band sound. And it was almost like you could write the article. Like, you know, it's very easy to say, well, if you don't like that, you're gonna love this, or in total reaction to this.
Right.
It wasn't really a reaction. We may have played that up a little bit in the press. It was just what we liked. But I think like the story, it made sense at the time. It's sort of, and you know, as a musician, it's not like you put more into those records that people love. It's just that they connect in some way. And, it's also, I think like for the first three, especially Hold Steady records, every one was like, it was more exciting each time. Like, you know, it was like you got to go to another town and people would show up and see you. And then all of a sudden you go to another town and it would be sold out. And then you're playing the bigger club that, you know, like you're just excited to be in there. And then, and all the stuff is just happening. And, you know, in a matter of months. And, and so it's very exciting, and people I think kind of want to climb aboard.
Ah, that's interesting. You mentioned Minneapolis. Is there a reason why such great music comes from Minneapolis, or is that stupid? Was there a reason why Liverpool or Seattle for a year or two? But Minneapolis, I just had sort of two scenes. Liverpool and Seattle were like quick scenes. Minneapolis goes on forever. From Bob Dylan to you.
Prince.
Between Prince. Is this true? I know I'm interested in my own question. I read this, and I hope this is true, that Prince, Jimmy Jam, Terry Lewis, Morris Day were on the same band in high school.
That may be true. I don't know. I think that Minneapolis is, it's just, I don't know if it started with Prince, or I don't think it started with Bob Dylan, because he moved away and he kind of even wouldn't admit that he was from there for a while.
Right,
so,
right.
But I think especially when Prince, and then in the early 80s when The Replacements and Husker Du came out, it felt like there was a pride of that in the city that's carried a lot of weight since. Like, it felt like people were like, we're unique here. To me, it's a very special place, but it's geographically removed from, you know, I mean, the next biggest city is Milwaukee or Chicago, right, which isn't that close. It's like 6 or 7 hours.
I've driven there.
Yeah. So it feels like, you know, you're up there, and especially before the internet, you were kind of doing your own thing, and you could, you know, even with, like, lift or puller, we never really connected on a national level, but we could still get a lot of people to come out to see us in Minneapolis. And there, we weren't the only band like that. There was kind of this own scene and this own world that created there.
I read somewhere that someone's theory, it may have been the guitarist from Soul Asylum, that the cold has something to do with the music scene.
I believe that staying indoors is probably helpful for the music.
We're going to take a little break, and we'll get back with Craig. And I'm Kevin McDonald. And oh, here's something you never thought I'd hear me say. You never thought you'd hear I say. We're going to hear a word from our sponsor. For you, the listeners of Kevin McDonald's Kevin McDonald Show, Casper is offering $50 towards any mattress purchase at Casper.com. The Casper mattress is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. It's got just the right sink, just the right bounce. It's made up of two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, that come together for a life well slept. The Casper mattress is now the most awarded mattress of the decade. So what are you waiting for? Go get one! To receive $50 towards any mattress purchase, go to www.caspertrial.com/Kevin McDonald. Again, that's www.caspertrial.com/Kevin McDonald for $50 towards any mattress purchase. We're also sponsored by Warby Parker. Warby Parker is offering Kevin McDonald Show listeners with a free 5-day home try-on to give you the opportunity to check out their glasses. Warby Parker makes buying glasses online easy and risk-free. Their home try-on program allows customers to order 5 pairs of glasses to be shipped directly to them, where they can try them on in the comfort of their own home and get feedback from friends, family, colleagues. Users can keep the frames for 5 days before sending them back free, using the prepaid returning shipping label with no obligation to purchase. To get your home try-on today, go to www.warbyparkertrial.com/Kevin McDonald. That was fun. I'm going to do it again. That's warbyparkertrial.com/Kevin McDonald for your free 5-day home try-on. Hello, I'm Kevin McDonald with Craig Finn, and we're back. I always wanted to be a DJ going, and now we're off to the races with Brian Adams. Cause it's like an, I just always wanted to say, we're off to the races. We're off to the races. I don't know if I heard that before. Here's an opinion question. I'm interested in people's opinions. I think I know the answer, because you've mentioned them a few more times, but here we go. Maybe it'll open a conversation. Do I say it the normal way people say it? Husker Du or Replacements?
Well, Husker Du is how I would say it, and I think that's right.
Sorry, is that the? I'm sorry, I missed the
question. I am. You know, that's like choosing between your children. I guess. I grew up more of a Replacements fan, but to say that, I think when I was 16, I would have said yes, the Replacements. But and then if you would ask me my second favorite band, I would have said Husker Du. So it's not like there's huge. It's funny. They're different things to me. I think Husker Du, like Replacements, were more romantic to me. They were less fast, less belligerent. Maybe had some kind of, they had more songs that you might impress a girl with, you know.
Right.
But as a musician, you know, now that I look back on both bands' careers, I'm extremely impressed by Husker Du's Do It Yourself, their touring and the prolificness of their catalog, and just what a massive amount of how much artistry and hard work was there. And so it's hard for me to pick one or the other. I really love both. But I think the Replacements are connected. The Replacements probably are a little more connected to Minneapolis in some way. Bob is, you know, came to Twin Cities to go to school there. So, you know, I don't know if that plays into it, but the Replacements had that sort of lovable loser thing that I think a Midwesterner. I don't know that I thought Husker Du were losers. I thought they were just like a train barreling forward. Where the Replacements, I mean, the Replacements were an interesting thing. Like when, you know, there was this narrative that you can hear like, oh, they almost made it. You know, they almost did it. And to me, I'm like, well, for a band that kind of tanked half their shows, they did pretty damn well.
Yeah.
You know, like
I know.
If any other band did that, they wouldn't be like well-loved. They would be.
And would that be the strength of the songwriting, do you think? Songwriting saves things like that, do you think?
I think in part, I think it's a little bit, if you build it, will come. You know, they could be the band that did that, but there couldn't be another one, you know?
Right.
But I think the songwriting, I think that they had, you know, when you talk about like a perfect mix of pathos, tenderness, and belligerence, and drunkenness, and then...
and wit,
and romance, and, you know, they just sort of had it all. You know, it was a perfect storm.
Ah, and sorry, I'll try to pronounce it better. Husker Du. I've read this, something you said about them that you remind me. Of course, I knew it, but I never really think about it because you think about Bob Moe. They had two great songwriters.
Grant Hart was an amazing songwriter as well, and a competitive spirit between the two.
In a good way, in a healthy way?
I don't know. That you'd have to ask them if it was healthy, but I think that in the sense that it created a lot of art, then I think, yes, very healthy. And I think that has to, I mean, they were putting out records every 9 months, you know, for a while and touring them hard. That's a spectacular. I mean, it's spectacular that those two bands were existed in Minneapolis, St. Paul at the same time. And I remember going, like, when my dad was in, like, he was a businessman and he would go to New York for work. And I would ask him to bring back the Village Voice to me, for me, because I would like to look at, like, the club listings in the back and see all the bands that were playing in New York. Oh, and wow. And I remember, like, getting the Paz and Chop poll of 1 year, and it was like, you know, Husker Du and Replacements were all the way up there. And I was, even at, you know, I was probably in eighth grade. And I was like, wow, it's crazy. Like, it feels like we're in the middle of the, you know, we're in the center of the universe, which is not something you say often when you live in Minneapolis.
Right. I love both bands, but I guess back then in the 80s, the Replacements were my favorite. But I just read the book on the Replacements.
Mm-hmm.
And the major reason was the songwriting. But part of the reason was that their spirit, it was sort of hip in a way, the way they would screw things up on purpose. But when you read the book, you get frustrated because they screw things on purpose all the time. Always the big show. They do it too drunk and they get like Saturday Night Live. Like, all they finally get a van with a bathroom. So what do? They trash the bathroom. Like, all the day. It stops being hip after a while.
There was some really like...
It becomes self-destructive.
There was some self-destructive. I read the book too and I thought it was fantastic.
Yes, Bob, it's a great book. It's a great book.
Amazing book. And the research involved was just so impressive. It's funny. I grew up in Minneapolis, obviously, and I they're my favorite band. So I thought I knew it all. But like, it turned out I didn't even know where Paul Westerberg went to high school. Like, and now I learned that from that book, which is cool. You know, some of these very inside and local things that I was like really impressed with. But there was stuff that, you know, like thinking about them trashing that van and that their manager had to like make a call. And I thought, well, that's not cool. That's not, you know.
You don't think about that, the manager making the call to the guy who was nice enough to sell the van?
Yeah.
A rock band should have a van, the guy said. Like,
yeah.
When you think about it in those terms.
We trashed it. Now you deal with it. Like, that's not great. Like, that's not how I would want. I don't think that part of rock and roll is cool. I think treating people well is cool.
Absolutely, yeah. It sounds sort of hip from a distance, but you're right. Funny. The reality of the manager having to call the guy.
You know, you trash the hotel room. Someone's got to clean it up. And even if you pay for it, you know, someone's like, not getting home on time because they're cleaning up the shards of glass from your TV screen or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Elvis. One more opinion question. Bob Dylan or Bruce Springsteen?
That's another one. I guess it's funny because I'm gonna qualify this and say Springsteen because I've spent more time with Springsteen. I was always like a Dylan fan that was just a medium fan. I hadn't gotten totally bit by the Dylan bug until maybe I turned 30 or 35, and
then
And now it's like my main thing. So it's like probably it's on it like the X and the Y axis, like the Dylan's going up.
Right.
Cause now it's like, oh my God, I haven't really heard that album. And there's outtakes and you can get, it's the thing I was talking about earlier when
it's
you're
exactly
at this age
it.
And you have this catalog to dive into.
And Dylan now, was his 40, 50 albums. And I think I have 35 of them. I've been on a Dylan kick. I'm totally.
It's great. And it's amazing. Like you can listen to the 80s ones. You're like, well, I don't love the keyboard tone on that, but what a song, you know? And I like a few months ago or within this year, I listened to the song Hurricane like 800 times in a row. Like I was just like, wow, what a song. And it's like, you know, it's socially conscious. It's a story. It's just, it's an incredible piece of music.
And it was the first socially conscious song in a while too. And it was like one of his best songs ever.
It's amazing.
And in a small way, it helped Hurricane Carter get out of prison, right?
Yeah, I think that's correct.
It opened the door to the door being opened. I guess.
And it's a weird, you know, you get into like, you see sort of like, obviously there's no Bruce Springsteen without Bob Dylan too, you know, like, it's funny, like you get older and you start to see like the threads. And I obviously Dylan leads to Springsteen,
right?
And
especially if you hear like Nebraska, which is one of my all-time favorite albums.
Yeah, yeah. But even the first two records, like you know, that,
oh
that
yeah, the lyrics,
all that poetry,
yeah,
and all
the lyrics. Yeah.
And you know, I mean, Bowie's another thing. Like you just hear it in all these things. Like, well, wow, that David Bowie, like. Like I still love the Psychedelic Furs. It's one of my favorite bands. Talk 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 is one of my favorite albums. And but I put that on now, and I'm like, as in my 40s, and I'm like, oh wow, David Bowie. Well, hello,
you know? Exactly. Like the one aspect of one of the many aspects of David Bowie.
Yeah, and like you know, I don't think like when I first got into that record at 16 or whatever, I was thinking like, this is super influenced by Bowie. I just like liked it. Sounded good.
So I'm a little older than you, so I remember us talking about that. It's a little bit like Bowie, but it's a good album.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that the one Todd Rundgren produced?
Did Todd Rundgren produce? I think he produced. I don't think he produced Talk Talk Talk, but I may be wrong.
No, I think you're right.
I think he produced the one after The Mirror Moves or something, but I may be wrong.
You could be right. Dylan, I don't know what my favorite album is. Is it Blood on the Tracks or Blonde on Blonde? You tell me what's my favorite.
I think Blood on the Tracks is probably my favorite. But, you know, that's probably my favorite. But even like Freewheeling, it's like there's stuff in that. Like, that's, I talk about funny. I mean.
Yeah. He wrote so many comedy songs at the beginning. And there's so many great songs that he wrote. That he didn't release that we get now, like in live performances.
That
were famous anyway. They were famous before they released them.
But then there's this other part of him that he's also kind of scary to me. He's not like someone like, oh, I'd love to meet Bob Dylan.
Yeah, I'd be very happy not to meet him.
Stay over there.
He'd be crazy and say something weird. And he may say something nice. I could see that. But it may,
there's just very little upside to meeting someone like that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe meeting Elvis Costello would get more out of it.
That would be cool.
When did you, was there a time in your life when you knew you were going to be a musician? Or did you accidentally stumble into it?
Well, both. I mean, I always wrote songs. I loved being, you know, I loved music. And I loved buying records and going to shows, and I had a band, but it didn't seem like it was going to happen in any like way that was going to allow me to really pursue it. Until, in fact, like when I moved to New York in 2000, Lifter Puller had broken up, and I kind of thought it was, you know, over. I was married, and I was thinking I was going to do something else. I thought New York would be part of figuring it out, and I didn't have a band for 2 years, and then Tad moved here, and we started playing. It was funny. It's amazing because we were really honestly having conversations like that would go like, okay, Tuesday night we're gonna start playing, but we're only gonna like just like play. We're not playing any shows. We're not gonna record. That was our two things. Like because that stuff's not fun. That's
right,
where
right.
The fun goes out of it.
Take the pressure off.
Yeah, and then we just would drink beer and play. But then of course we wrote some songs. Like, well, we might as well record them so we remember them. You know,
right.
And then play a show. And then you know, next thing you know, it's 13 years later. I don't know how many thousands of shows. I guess probably 1,000. I don't know.
Wow. I always think musicians want to, comedians want to be musicians, and musicians want to be comedians. Did you ever want to be a comedian?
Yes. I never would. What I would want to be is I've had a lot of jealousy when I've watched comedians roll up to the show without any equipment.
I love that, and rappers too.
Yeah, like I'm always like, yeah, man, wow, that's cool. Like, there's no bass cab if you're a comedian. You just get up there and do it. I mean, I think there's a lot of. I've always kind of had I mean, because Saturday Night Live or whatever, there always seems to be like comedy and rock kind of, you know, together. You know, you see it. And
they're United Arts. They are the United Arts, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I think maybe like more they've come like they were and now they've come back more. Maybe there's in the middle.
Ever since the Beatles and Python became friends or like right. Garrison. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I think they're kind of.
Yeah. No, well, like the Grateful Dead and Franken and Davis. Yeah. Were like, you know,
were they really?
Oh yeah, like the I think Franken and Davis, like, did they introduce the Grateful Dead movie?
They're from Minneapolis.
They are. They yes, are. Yeah, they are.
And they introduced the Grateful Dead.
The Grateful Dead movie, maybe, I think, is like they're in it. I don't know. I know they're dead guys. Wow. They've done stuff with the Grateful Dead. Yeah, but comedy and, you know, John Belushi obviously is
rock and roll.
Rock and roll and all the way to Fred Armisen. Fred Armisen, someone I would play shows with in Lifter Puller. He had a band called Trench Mouth.
Oh yeah, of course.
There's a lot of rock and roll. Yeah.
Dave Foley, when we were young and struggling, if he was a little drunk, he would say, "We're the Sex Pistols of comedy." And I was half embarrassed, but half agreed with him.
What one would you be then? Would you be Sid?
I'd be Sid, probably. No, I wouldn't be Sid. The Sex Pistols album. I know everyone's on this forever, but I just found it. I remember, like, everyone said, oh, they can't play their instruments. And when I was 60, I think there's two great times in rock and roll to be 16. In 77, when I was 16, when punk came out.
Yeah.
And when my mother was 16, when rock and roll started, like, yeah. 55. But I was, in a way, I was disappointed when I heard the Sex Pistols because I liked it so much. And I thought, they can play their instruments.
They can play their instruments. Awesome.
Because it's not Sid playing, right?
Right. Well, I don't think Sid was in the band yet, right?
When and it was a real that. Drummer. Was it a different drummer?
I don't know. But I do think it's one of the greatest sounding records of all time.
I do.
It's
they played
amazing.
Their instruments. And was it, I'm going blank, the guitarist. Was it really him that played on the record?
Steve Jones. I think that was him, yeah, because he's really great.
Right. But a different bass player and different drummer, perhaps.
Maybe. I'm not sure. But I see what you're saying because
I loved it, but also it's disappointing because I expected more noise.
And but when I heard it, it was like I was hearing things, you know. But by the time I heard it was probably 1983, and I was hearing it alongside things that like hardcore that was right. very rudimentary. And I'm like, no, that's not playing your instrument. The Sex Pistols sounded pretty pro.
It was Chuck Berry in a way. I remember also thinking that at 16. This is Chuck Berry, but with like themes that Chuck Berry would never write about.
Massive hooks. Massive hooks.
Really massive hooks. Did Johnny Rotten write the songs with Steve Jones? Like, what is that? Do you know
that's
that?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that, but I got to think Steve Jones was involved. And it's certainly my impression that he was involved but in the songwriting. But I don't know the answer to that, actually.
Because it is great hooks. When you were a teenager and you were thinking about music, did you vision your future as a solo artist or as a part of a band?
Always part of a band. I loved bands. I mean, from The Replacements. I mean, like, the first thing I saw ever that got me into music was the Monkees TV show. And I was like, they live together, girls dig them. You know, it was what wasn't to like? Like,
that's so true.
They could burst into song at any time. And I like that, and then Kiss, and then, you know, but always bands, and then The Replacements and REM and things like that. Always part of a band. I wanted to be a part of that, and I get it. You know, I mean, I get a band is a cool thing, even though it's a lot of work. You know, it's like it's like a marriage. You know,
oh, it's
like,
totally
like,
a marriage.
You know,
and the biggest thing, the example to me is Metallica. Are they the most famous? Lived in a van for like 7 years until they made it, and it's so hard to be together all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, but I've always pictured it as, I mean, you know, if nothing else, when you think about like a band name looks cool on a T-shirt, even looks cooler than, you know, David Bowie or Lou Reed, like someone's name, you know, I think like a band is there's
but some things as always.
Yeah, there's a mystery to it, you know.
I always ask this question. I'm fascinated by boring things, but was it a coincidence that you were a great songwriter? Like, I always think Bob Dylan. He moved to New York. He wanted to be Little Richard. He eventually wanted to be Woody Guthrie, and he probably would have been happy doing covers of old songs, which he does quite well. And then all of a sudden, he started writing his first song. And to me, he must wow, I can write songs. It must have been, like, in a way, it was an amazing coincidence. I don't think that was his first plan. How did that, how's your relationship with songwriting?
I tried to write songs, like, the second I had two guitar chords. I was like, that was, like, the reason I wanted a guitar was to write songs. I wanted, and I really liked, I mean, no surprise, but I really liked words in song, the words to songs.
Never
was into poetry, but, like, you know, put it to music, and I would, and my parents didn't have a ton of records, but they had, like, you know, like Paul Simon, and I would sit there and I would, like, listen to it and I would read along. And, like, you know, I still think of, like, Slip Sliding Away, you know, the Paul Simon song. There's, like, you know, some in the middle of one of the verses, he says, Dolores, I live in fear. And you're like, who's Dolores?
Yeah.
How did she get in here? And I realized I've taken that and I've used that, that kind of trick often throughout my songs, where, like, you know, in the second verse you are something like, wait, who's that? Juanita. Yeah. You know,
Dylan would do that too, to switch gears and
just sort of kind of.
So you loved the songwriting idea first. That's exciting to me.
Yeah, I wanted to write songs. I wrote songs probably starting in 7th 8th grade, and I still have a song, the Lifter Puller song. But was like one of the early, I wrote it before we started Lifter Puller. I wrote it in my college dorm room. It's called Mission Viejo. And, it's the oldest song I've written that I still like.
Wow. So and you still play live?
I will play it. Cause I still like it. And that's like, that was like my first good song. And that was probably when I was about 20.
Do you think that I'm right about Bob Dylan? That he, it was a coincidence he was a great songwriter, that he had no idea?
I don't think you're right that he'd be happy playing just other people's music. It doesn't seem like with a brain like his that there would be something unshared. Because I feel like, to me, like some, and I've come to this idea as I get older, that like there's some part of sharing or putting out your art that is very important and absolutely a part of it that must happen for it to kind of be art. You know what I mean? Like it has to be. You can't just like make little things and put them in a shoebox.
I guess it was just destined to be. He was young. He wasn't thinking the songwriting was just going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, that's a genius brain. What would it have done? I mean, like, you know, like it would have. I mean, unless it would have been splitting atoms or something. I do believe that there's.
You're right. I agree. He wouldn't have been happy playing. So it's funny. Every time he's in a songwriting block, he goes back to the old songs and releases albums of old songs. So it is something he enjoys.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, and then it's usually after that where the next classic album happens.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's interesting that both him and Springsteen and I think a lot of other great artists, but those come to mind, are very well versed in rock and roll's history.
Yes.
You know? And, you know, Bob Dylan had that radio hour and he played one time, like he played Take Me Out to the Ball Game, and it has all these different verses. Like, you know, and you're like, wow. And I know he's just sort of encyclopedic about folk and rock music.
Wow.
And that, I think, gives you a lot to draw on.
Yeah, and he once said, I kind of like everything. I asked everyone this question, though I'm guessing the answer. The last time I guessed the answer, I was wrong.
Okay.
What's your favorite thing of the rock and roll? Is it songwriting? Is it recording in the studio? Is it playing guitar? Is it singing? Is it touring? What's your favorite thing about your job?
I think the songwriting.
That's what I would have guessed.
But you know, I think I don't love the recording. Isn't like some people love that, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm like I'm big into like the song is captured. Like you know. But I like touring. I really do. I like touring more than a lot of people my age do. I don't have any kids or anything, so I'm kind of like free to roam a little bit. I have a girlfriend, a partner that I've been with for a long time, but and we live together. But you know, I don't have like I've set up my life so that I can do that, and I really do enjoy it. In fact, like I always like I'm a little bit jealous when I see bands that are like you know like. Like just you know, taken off in some far reach of the world. Like you know, we got this huge following in wherever you know, and they're you know get to go. Because I've always like wished I could go more places with it, but I have been blessed with being able to go to a lot of Europe and Australia and all around North America and all that. And I love the touring. I'm going to the UK in a few weeks, and I'm excited for that. And you know, that's not super exotic, but it's very exciting to me to be there and play there, and I've gone there a lot and I love it there, and all that kind of thing is really exciting to me.
What's your biggest tour? Like, do you go out for like 6 months or two months? Or
We just did 5 weeks. And
that's like perfect. Like 5 weeks and like home a little bit, then 5 weeks.
Yeah. Again? Well, no, usually it's shorter. Usually it's like three.
Right.
But five was pretty long for these days. And it was fine. It was great, actually. Like, sometimes like I've gone on tours that have shorter than that have felt long.
Right.
But this one was particularly great. So 5 weeks is fine. There's little different things that you can do to recharge in the middle. We did a lot of two-night stands on this tour, so that really helped.
Oh, it's great to stay in the city more than one night.
Yeah.
That's really great.
That's amazing. Yeah. You know? This one, I've toured a lot, especially with the whole study in a bus, but we toured in a van with this one. And actually, I felt like it was better mental health wise to sort of see the sun and see your surroundings and be a little more on a normal person's schedule. Like, all right, well, we got to start driving at 9, but then we'll stop for lunch at noon. And that's like normal, you know, like right. where like on the bus, you wake up and you usually sleep late and it's like noon and you're just getting up and you open the door to the bus. It's dark in the bus and you open up and the sun is shining and you're like, ah, and you don't feel like a member of society, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it is weird. I hate tours like that. I don't hate anything. There was one tour in 2007, I guess. We were in a tour bus and after every show, we'd go to the next city. And so you'd fall asleep at 4 a.m, they'd wake you up at the hotel, and it was the weirdest feeling. And then I'd go to the hotel room, and then I'd go to sleep again. And I didn't have nightmares. I had soundmares. I call them soundmares, where people were talking to me. Kevin, get back in the bus. What are you doing in the room? Get back
in the bus. Yeah.
It was sort of a nightmare, but I was dreaming that I was in bed in the hotel room. And that happened like 4 or 5 nights in a row. That freaked me. Because it's a weird lifestyle, like a tour bus lifestyle that way is kind of weird.
So you guys tour in a bus? Or you do?
We do something. This time we didn't. Was it to save money or because we're getting older and planes are more convenient? I forget the reason, but it was.
Let me ask you, when you guys cross a border, whether it's, you know, into the U.S. or out of the U.S., because rock bands, it's notoriously hard to cross a border. Does a comedy group, is it the same thing?
When we were younger, now we're like in our 50s, so they sort of trust us more. And there's always one guy that knows us now.
Yeah.
But yeah, when we were younger, it was really. And Scott always had his drugs.
No, okay.
Can I say this on Pug? Yeah.
The border? That's risky.
Well, we'd always have a fight the hour before we get to the border in the bus. We'd get, Scott, you have to get rid of it.
Yeah.
Well, you're not getting rid of your alcohol. Again, Scott, alcohol's not illegal.
Right.
You have to get rid of it.
Because, I mean, you know, I feel like I've been on debauched tours, but it's been pretty much everything's out of the bus. Like when we're crossing
a border.
You
got it, right?
Like there's nothing. Yeah, there's even riding over a border clean at 45 years old, I get nervous. Like I'm like, I don't know what's going to happen.
Anything, especially nowadays.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Although this, but even before then.
Yeah, yeah.
The last tour was easy?
Last tour, like it's funny, we kind of geared ourselves up for it. And I was touring, the band I was touring, you know, that was backing me up had an Indian guy and a Mexican guy. So it was like, oh, we're going to, you know, try to get back into the Trump's America. And it actually was, it's the funniest thing was we rolled up to, and we went around instead of going whatever that one straight down from Toronto was, we drove to the Thousand Islands.
Right.
Yep. And so
many times there as a kid.
We thought it would be chiller, you know?
Yeah,
And so we went, and it was a Sunday, and we go over and we've come up to the guy.
Oh, no.
And he comes up and he's like, you know, you guys band or something? And I said, yeah. And we said, yeah. And he said, what kind of music do you play? And I said, classic rock. And it was the smartest thing I've ever said. He's like, nice. You know? And he's like, you doing any of your stuff? Or you just got like, you know, some of your, you know, and I was like, yeah, we do some of our own stuff. You know? And he's like, all right. And then like he looked in the van and we didn't even have to get out of it, which is like
that's
never happened before.
Of.
But I think that's classic rock is the answer.
Wow. I'll say classic comedy.
Yeah.
Classic comedy. There was someone in Montreal, she was born in Canada. Her parents are from India. and she was planning. She's getting married. Her fiance is an American, and she went to plan her wedding, and they didn't let her in, and they didn't let her in anymore. And the guy said, "I know what you." The guy, the guard, when he didn't let her in, the guard said, "I know what you're thinking. You've been trumped." And like, what did he mean by that? I he didn't finish with "you're not being." I know you're thinking that, but that's how he ended. I always and now that's a verb. Now.
Yeah. It's changed the vibe when you. I mean, because it used to be like, I hope they let us into Canada.
Yeah.
Now you're a little bit like,
let us back in. Let us back in. Do you write politically? Well, the political situation, would that affect your writing, even if it's in a sideways kind of way?
I think it already has in a sideways. I mean, I think like in some ways, like We All Want the Same Things as a title of the new record is in some ways
right.
a nod to the divisiveness of these times. You know, I think like in this whole record, I was trying to create something that empathy for people who were struggling. And I think struggle is part of how we got here, you know, or people struggling and people looking for a Hail Mary or a savior, you know, like people did. I think, you know, right. I don't think like, I just sort of feel like there's at least some people out there that are like, well, this guy seems like a jerk to me too, but nothing else is working.
Yeah, I know.
So I don't know. I think it's got to. I mean, I think like you become, you know, when I was 25, I don't know that I read the newspaper, you know?
And right, right.
Now I'm like reading it hourly or refreshing certain sites and being like, what's, you know,
yeah.
Feels like things are happening on the hour now rather than on the day or
they
the
are.
Week.
It's so chaotic. I'm on, every time I'm writing, I go on CNN breaking news to see what's happening.
Yeah.
And quite often something's happening.
Something's happening, right? Yeah.
Quite often. Yeah, and I've been reading a lot about the Civil War. And when you think about the Civil War, I don't know why. I guess I was reading books by Abraham Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant. And it was only, what, 150 years ago? That's not long. There's still state personalities that aren't so dissimilar.
There's also, like, I'm really interested. Like, the last record I did, I had a song that was kind of about 9/11, which is like, why is there a song on 9/11 in 2015? And it's because I was really interested in those years that followed and sort of these hangover times, you know, where
right.
I was like, and I was thinking about, you know, like what about like, you know, the years 2001 to 2005 or so when everyone, you know, I moved here in 2000. So it was kind of fresh, but I just remember everyone was kind of edgy and drinking a lot and going home with each other very easily. Like there was a hangover.
Wow.
And I think about like, you know, thinking about the 70s movies we talked about earlier. That seems like, you know, Taxi Driver and what – all those movies seem like kind of a hangover from Vietnam, right?
Absolutely, you know? Absolutely.
And so, like, there are these, like, big events, political events, and then there's this sort of thing like, how does that affect,
right.
you know, life in New York City or, what you know, in Taxi Driver or whatever.
Your songs are like that. And then there's the reverse, the movie Network – sort of paved the way for like Trump in a way,
mm-hmm.
like a reality star becoming a president.
And that's in, I mean, there's something like that in Infinite Jest too, I think, and David Foster Wallace. I think the president in that is a former lounge singer, which is, you know, kind of Trumpian. I mean, that's Atlantic City, you know, gambling.
Wow. All right. I want to ask you this before someone gives me a signal. How did you get a song Game of Thrones? What was it?
They, you know, the guys, Dan and Dave, I believe are their names, asked that if we would – they did a song. Like, that song existed in the books. And so they – I think there had been some precedent.
Oh.
Like, I think The National had done one too where they said, we want to do this once a season where you guys – and they, you know, we've got this song – it's like a big drinking song, so it seems like the whole state would be good at it. And so we were like, yeah, it seems like that'd be fun. And I didn't really know. I know of the show, of course. Everyone watches it. My girlfriend watches it. I haven't watched it. It's things that are set in way different eras or fantasy things are hard for me. Because if there's a lot of costumes, I can't keep track of the characters. Gangster movies are kind of hard sometimes for me too, because I'm like, what Italian guy is that?
Right.
But some of the other guys watched the show and they were totally excited. I mean, I was excited too. But we got to go to the set in Belfast, outside of Belfast,
oh, wow.
And that was really cool. And even like as someone who didn't watch the show, that was kind of amazing because you just saw like how and some of the. I don't know if you like just how they like made these big landscapes look a certain way.
Right.
And like, you know, we got to go into some sort of ice world, which was cool.
So you wrote the song without knowing the show that well? Or?
Well, the song was written. I mean, so
not just lyrics, like the music too?
No, but to music we wrote, the whole study wrote. I mean, I think Tana had the idea, but it was kind of they sort of had a direction, you know, like drinking songs. So it kind of took care of itself. Right?
Okay.
Like, oh, yeah, it's that thing. It's
and you could live with it? It was a good song?
Yeah, it's great.
Excellent.
It's great, yeah. Excellent. I mean, you know, it's funny. I'll tell you the one thing. There's that. And then my friend, my one of my best friends, my best friend, Eddie Kitsis, is a television writer. And he wrote for a show, Lost. And he, in the second season of Lost, there is a scene where the guy, Hugo, the character, says, hey, would you like to go to a Hold Steady concert with me to this girl? And I remember we were in a diner in Canada on tour, and everyone's phone just went, like, and when you, my point is, when you interface with television,
right,
you realize how much bigger television is than music. Like so many people watch these shows. And even, you know, a successful indie band isn't even a blip compared to how many people watch, you know, Game of Thrones or Lost or something like that.
And music's different. Neil Young singing like against things like that. Now, don't hold water. Now that there's no hit singles, now an indie band having a song on a commercial is their hit single.
Yeah.
And I have no problem with that. Times have changed.
No, it's wonderful. You know.
That's how they would get a hit single.
Yeah, and especially I think it's like, yeah, absolutely. And especially like I do it all the time now. Like I'll be watching kind of, you know, a hip TV show that I'm watching. Like I'll be like, oh, what's that? And Shazam it. And like,
yeah.
Like I hear about things
and then
through that.
Get the album
like,
or something.
Yeah, yeah.
How has the shifting music industry affected your life? Does it mean you have to tour more or?
Yeah, I mean, or you're more hoping for those kind of things, those licensing things. But yeah, it's more tour. I mean, the touring is always going to be was always a better part of the business because, you know, when you go on tour, you even if say if records are selling, like you know, the record sells in the store and the store takes their cut, sends it to the distributor, distributor takes their cut, sends it to the label, label takes their cut, sends it to you. So you know, the touring. If for nothing, no other thing, you touch the money first. You know, you play the show and your tour manager gets paid. Now you've got the money and your agent's like, I need my cut. But you're like, okay, well, we'll give it to you. But, you know, like we're holding it right now. Like, so, I mean, like there's some power in that. But, you know, I mean, I think I'm not even though I've been doing this for a while, I'm still not of the era of like where records sold a lot. So there's nothing I'm missing. You know what
I mean? Right.
There was never a big check in my mailbox from record sales.
When did everything
sales.
Change? 2004? 2003?
I think probably right around then, yeah. I mean, like the Hold Steady's first record was 2004. And I think, like, I mean, to me it seemed like burning discs was the big thing. You know, like when you could be like, oh, I'm going to burn you a disc.
Yes.
That seemed like – and then that sort of, to me, was a big breakthrough, more so than the digital, like the streaming or anything like that, because it was like – oh, wait, the CD itself is just a glass, and what I really want is the water, right?
Right.
And so if I don't need the glass, you know, like I can still get the water, then I think that probably, that to me was the sea change.
Right. How do you feel about that? Do you wish it was back in the days where boys bands in the late 90s were selling 20 million?
I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it because it just can't, it's not going to be.
Right.
But I will say this, that I love the idea that more and more people are into vinyl because, you know, you create something and it's nice to have people listening to it in the form. And I still think of albums. Like, I think, this is going to be the first song on the second side. And I'll always think that way. So I'm glad people are like, you know.
I love to hold something. Like, I'm 10 years older than you, and it was albums. And I remember I bought Pet Sounds when I was a kid just because I liked the album cover. Yeah. And then when I went home and it actually ended up being a good record.
You're blessed.
Yeah,
right?
And it wasn't always like that. I didn't always, it always didn't turn out to be a good record, but it was to hold something. And sometimes I would just stare at the album cover as the music was played.
Yeah, me too. I think we all did that. And that was sort of, that's how it started. That's one reason I'm here.
Yeah. Do you think that it's sort of, in the mid-60s, are we singling? Last question. In the mid-60s, it became about albums.
Yeah.
Do you think it's reverting back to singles in a way?
It is for sure, but for a lot of people, but not necessarily for me. But yeah, I mean, you know,
you always think in terms of albums.
Think of albums, but I think like most probably
like the top 10 is sort of thinking in terms
younger people, I'm sure, like, yeah, you know, like think of like, oh, I just like, what's this album? It's interesting. I mean, you know, like I still am like, oh, let's make that the weird eighth song, you know? And you know, I think probably someone who's 20 is like, wow, you need a weird eighth song,
right?
You know, like, what, like, but to me, that sort of fleshes out the personality of the artist.
Absolutely.
You know?
And my stepkids, they get singles on their listening machines, whatever they're called. They don't get a whole person's album. That would
right.
be crazy.
Right. That's crazy though. Not crazy to me though. We're still here.
That was a bad last question. It should have been more about you, but I really enjoyed this talk.
Oh, me too. It was a lot of fun.
And now will you do a song for us?
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Now, this is called Be Honest. Well, her body was an outpost for ideas that didn't work. A nation failed and broken, invaded and then burned. And the crumbles and the ashes that settled in her purse were the ruins of an empire and the people we once were. We were limping up towards Lake Street, and she motioned towards the church. She said, the hardest thing they asked me is, Amanda, does it hurt? 'Cause it's not pain, it's more like pressure on the edges of my eyes. I see scales and bloody feathers when I look into the lights. And my password is be honest, and my network is evolved, and I can't guarantee a pickup every time that you call. Ain't it spooky when they all go away? Ain't it strange how they just disappear? Really sucks getting sick on the bus. It's even worse when the teenagers cheer. Ain't it funny how we all get by, but not the way that makes us laugh? The lust burns off into handshakes and hugs, and the end it comes down to the cash. I was calling from the car park when they kicked in the door. They pulled the pistols from the holsters, put the people on the floor. It's not the fear, it's the frustration, getting sick of being scared. They pulled your princess to her feet and made a handle from her hair. I was thinking about the progress, how a change is gonna come. I was hearing the announcements, I was running from the guns, and desperation fueled the dancers. Well, that's a sadness in the sex. And we lingered over dinner, and we ran out on the chick. And our safe word is still stop it, and our style is self-involved. And I can't guarantee pick up every time that you call. Ain't it something other people switch partners? You just gotta wait your turn. It's really hard getting kicked in the heart. It's even worse watching big buildings burn. Ain't it strange how it all fades to black just when it starts to feel really nice? I was banging around your party trying to locate all the love and the light. Well, the speed had crested early, then it ran its course. So I showered and got ready, and I started on my chores. It was rushing through my blood, it was coming from my pores. And my heart was charging forward, and I threw up off the porch. And we were limping up towards Lake Street. She motioned towards the church, said the hottest question ever is, Amanda, does it hurt? 'Cause it's not pain, it's more like pressure.
some ways that's much worse. The ruins of an empire, the people we once were. If revolution's really coming, then we'll all need to be well. So maybe it's just best if we both take care of ourselves.
Let's be honest.
Forever Dog.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Joe Dog. Cilio, Alex Ramsey, and Brett Boehm. For more podcasts, please visit ForeverDogProductions.com.